Please join me in the book of Judges, chapter number 3. We're going to start in verse 11 in just one moment. The period of the judges is a period of a cycle of the Israelis sinning whenever they don't have a strong leader. Now, back in my undergraduate years, almost 40 years ago now, I had an Old Testament professor who gave us an illiterate list of the stages of this cycle, which I still remember to this day. So I'm going to share it with you. They all start with the letter S. They would start with sin. And once Israel sinned, God would allow them to come under the subjugation of a foreign power. And after they spent some time underneath that boot, they became very sorry that they had sinned. So we have sorrow as step number 3. Eventually that sorrow caused them to cry out to God. So supplication was the next stage. And eventually God would then listen to the word of the people and send them a Savior. So salvation is the final stage. And they would end up with a new judge. So those steps are, if you're interested again, sin, subjugation, sorrow, supplication, salvation. And then they just kept repeating every time their judge died. Well, we know that the first technical judge would have been Joshua. He led the people into the Promised Land, and he was the strong guy that defeated a little over 30 of the fortified cities of the Canaanites and gave the Israelis this core territory. And then he expected them to spread out as God gave them allotted territories to fulfill the promises made to Abraham. Well, the tradition is that Joshua was the leader of Israel inside the land for about 25 years. And that fits very well with his age at the time of the conquest, the time of his death at 110. So I put his death date right around 1392 BC. And very shortly after that, I believe probably the next year, Israel had already boiled over with sin. And God allowed the first oppression to take place, the first subjugation. And that was Cushan-Rishathaim out of Mesopotamia, out of Aram. And for 8 years, he oppressed the Israelis at God's permission. And they were sorry about it, and they eventually begged God, they supplicated God, and God sent them Othniel, the little brother of the other good judge, or the other good leader of Israel, and that would be Caleb. And Othniel was living down in the south, but he went north and dealt with the northern invader and put an end to it with God's grace. And then he became the next strong leader for Israel. So we pick up in Judges chapter 3, verse 11. So the land had rest 40 years. Now that's a rest from external enemies. It's not an internal rest, because we know that Israel was still bubbling with all sorts of problems. We illustrated some of that with an event that took place under the high priest Phinehas yesterday, actually the last 2 days. And the near extinction of the tribe of Benjamin. I believe that all took place during this 40-year period of Othniel's leadership. And I put that at 1384 to 1345 BC. So by that time, by the time we get to the end of Othniel's life, Israel has been out of Egypt almost 100 years. Verse 11 continues, then Othniel the son of Kenaz died. And without that strong leadership, sin blows up to the surface again. Verse 12. The people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of He Who Is. And He Who Is strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done what was evil in the sight of He Who Is. He gathered to himself the Ammonites and the Amalekites and went and defeated Israel, and they took possession of the city of palms. So Eglon is the latest king in Moab, which is on the east side of the Salt Sea or the Dead Sea. So they're a near neighbor to Israel. And Eglon is pushing his power outward from his territory. He would have first pushed northward into the annexed territories of Israel on the eastern side of the Jordan. He had as his confederates, his near neighbors, the Ammonites and the Amalekites. And once they'd established that control, he pushed across the Jordan westward and took over the Jericho Plain. Now, the ruins of Jericho were there, and apparently there was a new city growing up nearby that is simply referred to as the City of Palms, the City of Palm Trees. And so he puts a sort of palace in that City of Palms and uses it as his base for collecting tribute from those portions of Israel that he now exercised control over militarily. Verse number 14 tells us how long that went on. The people of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. So more than twice as long as the last oppression that they were under. And then, verse 15, the people of Israel cried out to He Who Is, and He Who Is raised up for them a deliverer. So here comes the new judge, Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, a left-handed man. Now, this is probably a fairly young man. I'm guessing he must be in his 20s. And he is left-handed, just like so many of the Benjamites appear to be, which is rather ironic when you know the name Benjamin means son of the right hand. So the sons of the right hand, many of them are left-handed. And the fact that this guy has a dominant left hand becomes part of the story in a moment. So the people of Israel sent tribute by him to Eglon, the king of Moab. So here comes Ehud down into the Jordan Valley from up in Benjamin territory, probably. And he brings with him all of the required silver, gold, whatever other materials, perhaps wool or grain, Eglon is requiring each year from the Israelis to not do them in militarily. Ehud has clearly had a message from God that it is time for Eglon to come to an end. So verse 16, Ehud made for himself a sword with two edges, a cubit in length. So he makes himself a great big knife. It's 18 inches long. That probably includes the hilt, I would guess. It's two-edged, and he bound it on his right thigh under his clothes. So most people were right-handed. And so that would be the dominant hand they would use for their sword fighting. And the best place to put your sword, when you're right-handed, is on your left hip. And so that's the place that most people would be expected to have a weapon, and that's where you would be searched. More than likely, they would have patted down everybody on both hips just to make sure that they weren't carrying a knife. But Ehud, aware of the security procedures at the palace, he takes his 18-inch combat knife, is what I'm going to start referring to it as, and he secures it on the, more than likely, inside of his right leg, his right thigh, underneath his robe, so that he can bow down or bend over and grab it with his left hand, pull it out of whatever sheath he's got it in, and start fighting. So he's all ready to do this combat mission, this assassination. Verse 17. He presented the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now, Eglon was a very fat man, just a statement of fact. And when Ehud had finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people who carried the tribute. So he brought the stuff, the people who were carrying a lot of it, probably the gold and silver part, they're now dismissed. Verse 19. But he himself turned back at the idols near Gilgal. So Gilgal was the beachhead city of Joshua's entry into Canaan. And that means it is east of the ruins of Jericho. And since Ehud is leaving the city of palms and heading back toward Benjamin and the hill country of Ephraim, that must mean that the city of palm trees must be east somewhere of Gilgal. So that means it's not right next to the ruins of Jericho, but it's fairly near the ruins of Jericho. The reason I'm emphasizing this is because the tradition has grown up over time that Jericho is the city of palm trees mentioned in this text. But geographically, that doesn't make complete sense because of this Gilgal reference. So he himself turned back at the idols. These would be worship idols that either Moab people had brought with them or which the Israelis had been using. And remember, this is the period of the judges. Everybody's doing what they see fit in their own eyes. So he turned back at the idols near Gilgal, and he said to the king, remember, I have a secret message for you, O king. So he comes back into the audience chamber and says, I've got a secret message to pass on to you. He commanded silence. And then all his attendants went out from his presence. So he's thinking that Ehud has information that's important for him to hear about what's going on here in Israel. Ehud came to him as he was sitting alone in his cool roof chamber. The Dead Sea is very close to where we're talking about here. It's the lowest place on the face of the earth, 1,400 feet below sea level. It is warm there all the time. And in the summer, it gets sweltering hot. I'll just share with you the last trip that I went to Israel on. We were there in May. And at 10 o'clock at night, in the dark, up on the roof, calling home to talk to my wife, it was 110 degrees still. It's hot there. So you need a cool roof chamber so that you can get a good cross breeze to cool off. So that's where they went for this little private conference. Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. So he tells the king, God wants you to know something. Now, what's the message? The message is, you're done. So he arose from his seat And Ehud reached with his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh, and thrust it into his belly. And the hilt also went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, but he did not pull the sword out of his belly, and the dung came out. So he stabs the man through the belly into the heart region, it seems, from this text, and kills him. But he can't get the knife back out because this guy is so fat, it just closes right over the whole weapon. And after he's finished the deed, which is God's command for him, let's never forget that. The message was from God to Ehud, or to Eglon, you are done abusing my people. And so verse 23 says, Ehud went out into the porch, or into the room in front of this private chamber, and he closed the doors of the roof chamber behind him and locked them. And so they had locking mechanisms. Ehud probably took whatever key that the king had and used it to lock the chamber. And once he had gone, the servants came, and when they saw that the doors of the roof chamber were locked, they thought, surely he's relieving himself in the closet of the cool chamber. Which some people have suggested that maybe they thought he was going to the bathroom. So they waited till they were embarrassed. So they wait and wait and wait and wait for him to call them to come and help, because he is a big, big guy. And so he's going to need assistance for pretty much everything that he does. He doesn't call, and so they're afraid that maybe something's happened. Verse 25 continues, when he still did not open the doors of the roof chamber, they took their key and opened them, and there lay their lord dead on the floor. Ehud escaped while they delayed, and he passed beyond the idols and escaped to Syrah. And when he arrived, he sounded the trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim. So what's described here, and we don't know exactly where this place Syrah is, it must be up on the central highlands of Israel, in the area of Bethel and maybe Shiloh, somewhere in that region, where he is now in Israeli-held territory. And it says he sounded the trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim. So he sounds the trumpet of mustering the militia. It's a call to action. Then the people of Israel went down with him from the hill country, and he was their leader. So he is their new judge, and judges always start with a military action. Verse 28, and he said to them, follow after me, for he who is has given your enemies, the Moabites, into your hands. So they went down after him, and they seized the fords of the Jordan against the Moabites and did not allow anyone to cross over. So the first action he does is he cuts off their opportunity to easily retreat. Now the Jordan River, back at this time, was a fairly significant river. You could swim in it most places. But there were some places that were low enough, depth-wise, that you could have your feet on the bottom of the riverbed and walk across, maybe keep things up above your head. It might have been chest high or waist high, depending on the time of year that it was. And so this is called a ford. So they go to the place that they know everybody is in the habit of crossing. And they take control of that choke point. And then elements of their military force attack the Moabites. Verse 29, and they killed at that time about 10,000 of the Moabites, all strong, able-bodied men. Not a man escaped. So they kill the occupiers that are there on the plains of Jericho at the city of palm trees, not very far from Gilgal. 10,000 of them. I am certain that the next thing that would have happened is that they would have crossed over the Jordan and eradicated all Moabite presence in the southern part of the annexed territories. And there would have also been an uprising anywhere else that Moabites had barricaded themselves inside the Promised Land and inside the annexed territories of the Israelis. Once that's done, Moab ceases being a threat to Israel any longer because God is now functioning as their protector again. Verse 30, so Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest for 80 years. Now that 80 years probably represents the remainder of Ehud's life. And we do not have the details of his judgeship, that is, his functioning as the strong leader of the Israeli people. But the pattern seems to hold that as long as Israel had a strong judge, they behaved themselves for the most part. Sin was still probably going on, but it was kept under wraps. It was kept under control for the most part. And you know what will happen is eventually he will die and the sin will boil up to the surface once again. Now, by my calculations, that 80-year period where Israel was not being hassled from the outside would have been from 1327 to 1248 BC. So by the time we're done with that, it'll be almost 200 years since they came out of Egypt. We have moved on several generations from the time that the Israelis were slaves in Egypt. Now, I believe that that 80-year peace also included some leadership by the next guy. I think there's an overlap here. Verse 31, after him was Shamgar, the son of Anat, who killed 600 of the Philistines with an ox goad, and he also saved Israel. So this guy that we know very little about, other than his name and what he did in this one instance, he apparently dealt with some pressure that was coming from the west, and that would be the Philistine territories. The Philistines had five key cities that were on the Mediterranean coast and a little bit inland from there on the flatlands that the Israelis should have been in occupying. They should have been living in it, but no one had yet pushed the Philistines out. And so he apparently fought with an ox goad, a farm instrument, a stick with a little point on the end. Typically, it was a metal reinforced point that you'd use to make animals do what you wanted them to do when they were stubborn. So he takes out 600 Philistines with that instrument because God was on his side. But then Shamgar's gone. And Ehud is gone. Let's set up our story that we'll talk about more tomorrow. Judges chapter 4. The people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of He Who Is after Ehud died. And He Who Is sold them into the hand of Yabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. So you know the pattern. Once the Israelis fall back into sin, which seems to happen very rapidly, God takes away the protections and allows them to be subjugated. And in this time, it is a Canaanite who has taken back over the Canaanite city of Hazor, which is just a few miles north of the Sea of Galilee. Massive complex there. Been there, just amazing what's there. The city had been burned by Joshua, but now has been rebuilt by this Yabin. And he's reigning in Hazor and now expanding his control southward over the Israelis. And he has an assistant. It says here, the commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. Now, this city seems to be inside a pass that goes out of the plain of Jezreel and Megiddo southward toward the Mediterranean coastline. And there's evidence that there was a Gentile command post right in that area that was also used for chariot forces. Because we read next, verse 3, then the people of Israel cried out to He Who Is for help, for He had 900 chariots of iron, and He oppressed the people of Israel cruelly for 20 years. So that'd be, by my calculations, 1247 through 1228 BC. So Sisera is the power of this northern king, Yabin. And Sisera has these chariots that he can run up and down these passes between the plains of Jericho and the plains of Jezreel and Megiddo on the north, and also get down on the Mediterranean coast to the south and west. These same chariots can also run up and pass the Sea of Galilee and up through the plains that are north of the Sea of Galilee, just below Hazor. So they have very close control of all the flatlands that are in the north half of Israel. And tomorrow we'll come back and see what happens next.